What's up, baseball fans? Matt Coggins here, one of the hosts of this podcast, Put Me in Coach, a podcast all about baseball. You'll be hearing from my co-host, Carl Mizell, very soon. This week, we're taking a little bit of time off. Carl's traveling. He's getting some intel for us down in Arlington at Globe Life Field. And I am about to play my first softball game since I was a kid, like 10 years old. A very exciting week for us behind the scenes. But then, of course, that means that we let the podcast work get a little on the back burner. And so we're going to give you a little bit of a rerun this week. And I thought, well, what's a perfect episode that we could go back to? It's our umpires episode, because this week has been rife with umpiring shenanigans. If you're not aware, Aaron Boone was thrown out of a Yankees A's game by a tyrannical umpire who thought he heard Boone chirping at him, but instead it was a fan in the stands. And when asked for clarification why the umpire did this, he refused to admit any kind of mistakes. He refused to say anything was wrong other than Aaron Boone deserved to get thrown out, which is crazy. And that's not even the, like, I don't know, that's not even the only thing that happened with umpires this week that was nuts. Umpires, like, screaming at players and managers that I didn't fuck up. I saw that in, it was like a White Sox game, I think. I don't know, man. It's a wild time. And these umpires, when we did this episode last year, they were already wildly out of control. And that was when Angel Hernandez had missed, like, half the season with injury. And now he's back and fucking up games again. So our episode, we did this last year. It covers where the umpires came from, the history of the job, how they became so powerful, like why their union is what it is, and how they're basically unstoppable with how their positions work and how their union works. And I think it worked really well. This is the episode in its entirety, and we will be back next week with some more baseball content, a brand new episode from the two of us, and Carl will give us a little bit of a recap of what he found out down in Texas. So until then, thanks for listening, and please enjoy this rerun of Put Me in Coach. All right, Carl, what are we talking about this week? I feel like we've been a little cagey about that.
We have, and I don't think that's... I don't think that's by accident, because there's not a lot of transparency into umpires. Ooh. And so we didn't have a little transparency into our topic, which is umpires. We are talking about what we intend to talk about: the history of umpires, the future of umpires. We're going to talk about robo umps. We're going to talk about umpire unions. And we're also going to potentially talk about this season of umpiring and some really good performances and some really not so great performances. I was scouring the internet looking for the best and the worst of umpiring this year. Oh, and we're also going to talk about how you actually become an umpire. So we've got a lot on the agenda. So let's try and muscle through it and figure out where we're going to end up on the time, the runtime of this episode.
This might get split into two episodes, and we'll try to balance the story of how the umps came to be and what's wrong with them. But this has been kind of
we don't have enough time for that.
Kind of an episode, a long, long time in the making, and we're finally tackling probably the most controversial subject in baseball right now. So I'd like to start by talking about September 14th. MLB umpire Angel Hernandez called what was not only the worst umpired game of this season, but the worst in over 5 years. Adjudicators determined he missed roughly 20% of ball and strike calls. And this isn't really a huge surprise, given that Hernandez is notoriously one of the worst umpires in the league. He's so bad, he was barred from covering the World Series, sued the league for discrimination over that, and had his case thrown out because the judge determined, no, you just suck at your job.
Yeah. I actually put the image of the umpire scorecard from that game.
Oh, really?
Down in the notes. It's down in page 9, and you can see, and I've got a link if you want to put it in the show notes so people can see how
Jesus
bad it
Christ.
Was. Yeah. First of all, look at all of the, all the red dots, which are the pitches that, those were balls that he called strikes. And then that green 3, that's clearly like 5 inches in the bottom of the zone.
It's called a ball.
He called that a ball. He called that strike a ball.
Two of them are from the same at bat. Oh my God.
Yeah.
65% called strike accuracy. That is horrendous.
Yeah, I did. I actually put some notes in here about that. Yeah, his overall accuracy that game was 84% against an expected accuracy of 92%, which is giving Angel Hernandez way too much fucking credit, with an abysmal 65% on called strike accuracy. Of the 34 called strikes in that game, 12 were true balls.
Now, what shouldn't go overlooked about all this is that this game isn't really an outlier. I mean, it is the worst called game in half a decade. But truly, Angel Hernandez has been bad for a long time. As far back as 1999, when a poll ranked him the worst in the league. He almost got laid off when they were reshuffling the league. We're going to talk about that a little later. In 2010, he was identified by nearly a quarter of players as the worst umpire. He has a career 75% overturn rate since 2016, thanks to the new system of video replay challenges. He is a household name for baseball fans simply because of how shitty he is at his job.
You know, you want to know how bad he is? My wife knows who he is.
I was going to say, people that don't even know baseball know the name Angel Hernandez.
He is, unsurprisingly, the worst umpire in Major League Baseball this year behind the plate. And that's not saying too much. Normally, I'd give anybody else a pass. He's only been behind the plate for 8 games this year versus a lot of other umpires who have been behind the plate almost 30, like anywhere between like 26 to 30 times.
Sure.
He did have an injury early in the season. But he is still based. If you go to umpire scorecards and they have all that great data there, he is still the worst umpire this year.
He's joined the season late, but he's definitely in midseason form. Kind of leads us to the subject of umpires in general, because like, why in the world is this guy who's been bad for over 20 years, notoriously bad, why does he still have a job? Like, if I was bad for 1 year, I would be fired, right? Like any of us.
Yeah.
The most hated people behind Rob Manfred, A-Rod, John Fisher are the umpires. And many have claimed it's one of the hardest jobs in the game, and we do not disagree. I think it is definitely a hard job. Strike zone's not actually there. You can't see the little floating box like you see on TV. You know, it changes from batter to batter depending on how tall or wide the batter is. And generally, it's hard to see where this ball lands in an imaginary box when it's being thrown at 90 miles an hour directly toward you. But you know, that said, when you pay somebody to do a job, you expect them to do it competently. Not perfectly, competently. A 2019 study by Mark Williams of Boston University concluded that umpires miss, on average, 1 out of 5 ball strike calls, roughly 14 per game, or 1.5 an inning. Now, younger umps tend to be more accurate, but across the board, accuracy decreases later the game goes on, and on a 2-strike count. There's just a serious concern for how well these guys are performing at their jobs, even if a decent chunk of them still call a game like roughly 90% accurately.
Yeah, it's difficult. It's a difficult job. I'm listening to Keith Law's Smart Baseball, and he has an entire chapter making the case for robo-umps. And one of the biggest reasons for that is what is called the anchoring effect or anchoring bias, which is umpires have a tendency, just like any other humans, to not view each pitch as an individual isolated incident, which is why you see the strike zone get bigger on a 3-0 count and you see the strike zone get smaller on an 0-2 count, because umpires, A, don't really want to affect the outcome too much, but B, they're anchoring their next call. They're biasing, you know, their next call based on what they have already seen. Like, there's no way this guy's going to throw four straight balls.
Right.
So that strike zone's going to get a little bit bigger versus, well, this guy hasn't been that great all night.
It's more than human error. It's human intervention.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, the level of disdain for umpires from players, managers, and fans is not without merit, because there's little to no transparency. There's no level of scrutiny or punishment, really, for the umpires with bad performance. And worst of all, they're kind of openly hostile toward the players themselves and managers. And it's only gotten worse and worse as the years have gone on, and really combatively worse. When you especially see guys like Hernandez or Bellino. The fact that I even know their fucking names just pisses me off. But anyway. So
I was going to say, I still chuckle whenever I think of Phil Cuzzy.
Cuzzy. Bogner, the hits. We're gonna talk about them all, because this week on the show and potentially next week, we're gonna explore the history of umpires, rise to power through aggressive unionization, some of the worst offenders over the years, and what the future may have in store. So I want to dive into the history of baseball umpires because I did all this research and found it quite fascinating. I actually want to thank Larry Gerlach. I don't know if Larry's still alive because the website I found this history of umpiring on looked like it was made around 1999.
A bit of Angel Fire going on
there. But it was a really, really enlightening and deep dive into the history of umpiring. Could have been a short little book itself. So shout out to Larry. And let's dig into the history of umpires. Umpires have been a part of the game since the beginning of the game. An initial rulebook from 1845 included a designated officiant, sometimes a volunteer or fan from the crowd. It became a profession in the post-Civil War era, paid variably by the home team or eventually the league. And that's all thanks to William McLean from Philadelphia. He was the first professional umpire, and he umpired the very first game in National League history between Boston and Philadelphia in 1876. 2 years later, he was basically able to convince the National League that he deserved a paycheck. And so, along with his cohort, the National League instructed home teams to pay umpires $5 a game and also kind of created the first umpiring circuit, a group of 20 guys from which teams could choose an umpire, therefore becoming baseball's first umpiring staff. Umpires were also given the authority to impose fines for illegal acts. So, you know, whatever they deemed was against the rules or against the law. A couple years later, in 1882, Richard Higham of Troy, New York, a former manager and National League player, was banished from the league for advising gamblers on how to bet on games he umpired. He's the only umpire of being judged guilty of dishonesty on the field.
Wow. We have come a long way.
Yeah. We've talked a little bit about our conspiracy theory that maybe there might be some umps that are on these betting sites, and I wouldn't put it past. I mean, there's a lot of guys. Betting is so easy to do now. Richard may not be the last umpire banned for gambling, but we'll see. So far, he's the only one. American League finally starts paying their guys, and it's been a decent chunk of time now, so they're getting $140 a month and $3 a day per diem on the road, but they also have a dress code, the very first blue flannel and cap, and that is why we call them blue.
Yeah, and depending on where you don't want to call too many umpires blue because they take that as an insult.
Ah, well, they also don't wear it anymore.
Exactly, so then you're just being a real shit.
And I was like, why are you calling them blue? Because they wear blue. No, they don't. Oh. Prior to the golden age of baseball, there were a number of notable umpires. We've got, of course, Billy McLean. You know, he was a part-time boxer and was the first guy that convinced people to get paid. But there was also Robert Ferguson and John Gaffney, who were seen as the two best examples of umpiring style dichotomy. Ferguson was a hard ass who ruled as an autocrat, while Gaffney, known as the king of umpires, was very diplomatic and easygoing. Gaffney also popularized the technique of working behind home plate until a player reached base and then he'd move behind a pitcher. Because I think an important element I haven't mentioned yet, there was usually only one umpire in these early days. Sometimes two, but usually had one guy. He would usually stand behind home plate or behind a pitcher, depending on where he chose to be. And it would also make calling balls and strikes a little bit more difficult than it is now. But so that's kind of Gaffney kind of decided like, oh, I'll do that. And then I can be on near the bases to determine who's safe or not.
Did you, when you went to the Cyclones game, did you notice how many umpires were on the field for that?
Fewer than normal.
Yeah, but a lot. Even at some of the lower professional levels in the minor leagues, I think up to double A, I think they only use two.
Mm-hmm. I want to say there might have been three, but I do remember clocking that there was the second base / first base umpire. Depending on who was on base, he would move between the bases to determine who was safe or not.
Yeah, it's a skill. It's like playing three-handed euchre. It's not something you can do easily.
By the early 1900s, they finally started adding more of these guys on. So by the 50s, a four-man crew was the standard. Nowadays, you usually have a five-man crew, and one guy is kind of sitting out just in case you need a replacement. Lately, there's been a couple umpire injuries that have forced them to only have a three-man crew, which I found interesting. And in 1935, George Barr of the National League opened the very first umpire training school in Hot Springs, Arkansas. A couple years later, the Bill McGowan School for Umpires opened, and training schools became the norm by the 1960s. We'll dig a little deeper into them. Let's see. We've got a couple, Connolly and Clem. Thomas Connolly, Bill Clem became the first umpires in the Baseball Hall of Fame in 1953. 56, Ed Rommel and Frank Umont broke a longstanding taboo by becoming the first umpires to wear eyeglasses on the field.
Wow.
And now that we've got the first bespectacled umpire, a few short years later, 10 years later to be exact, 1966, Emmett Ashford becomes the first black umpire in the league when he reached the American League after 14 seasons in the minors. Took him even longer to break the color barrier for umpires, if you can believe it.
I actually can. I'm not at all surprised.
Now, throughout the course of this history, as the practice of umpiring kind of became the standard that it is today, the style of umpiring has changed, and that's a lot thanks to television and instant replay. It kind of had an effect pretty much from the get-go, the second they put cameras in the stadiums. Umps were initially very subdued and anonymous. Once the cameras came in, they were very flamboyant and demonstrative. This is when you finally got the kind of thing. Earlier, they were just kind of like, one, two, you're out. Okay. This is an audio medium, I know. Slow motion replays became a thing in the late 70s. And at one point, a crew in 1975 left the field and refused to return unless they stopped showing replays on the board.
Imagine being such a thin-skinned penis that you cannot handle.
That's umpires for you.
The idea. Oh yeah, and it's only going to get worse. It's only going to get worse from here. You're going to hear some stories. I've read the script. It's bad.
So the history of umpiring wouldn't be complete if we didn't talk about the most important element of the job, and that is the union. Now, I want to make a little editor's note here. We are a very pro-union podcast. I myself am a member of IATSE Local 306. We support all the striking workers of UAW, SAG-AFTRA, WGA, etc. We do not support the umpires union.
Thank you. Thank you. I've said that to you in private before. They're the only union that makes me question my love of unions.
And police unions. Just those two.
Oh, and, yes.
Just those two.
Also those two. Yeah, and I think there's a lot of overlap between umpires and cops.
I bring it up later in the notes, but I think the gist of it is umpires unions, police unions, what they represent is a level of authority that you usually don't see in striking workers or collective bargained workers in general. Workers are supposed to be the proletariat, the worker. They're not supposed to be the person telling other people what to do or enforcing laws, enforcing rules. I think that's kind of the heart of what's wrong with the umpire union. But it came out of necessity because the league wasn't paying these guys. And hate them or not, they needed to get paid. Around the 60s is when they started to collectively organize. They were the league was firing people for union activity in the late 60s, early 70s. So the umps in 1970 conducted the very first umpire strike, which was during the first day of the playoffs. So the NLCS or the NLDS and the ALD or no, this was before DSs, whatever. The first day of the playoffs.
Yes, before the divisional season. Yeah.
The first day of the playoffs had no umpires and resulted in universal union recognition. The league folded very quickly, doubled salaries to $21,000, which was a pretty decent salary in the early 70s. They struck again a year later, and that was, what was it for? Pay raises again. Richie Phillips became the general counsel and executive director of what would be known as the Major League Umpires Association and recognized by both the National and American Leagues. They struck again in 1979, forced the league to acknowledge how dire the game would be without them because the league hired scabs to replace them. And these scabs were apparently terrified of the players. They hated making calls. They hated being the bad guy. And so
asking them what they thought the call should be.
The league folded less than a month later, settled the dispute. Terms allowed umpires to have in-season vacations, utilized additional umpire crew for each league, gave them a 401k, increased their salaries, pensions, per diems, and returned to a merit-based assignment for postseason games. And that's actually kind of important because that's current now. You don't have, you didn't have merit-based before. It was all rotation-based. Whoever was next, that's your turn. And thank God for the union for that, because we would see Angel Hernandez in the fucking World Series nowadays.
Could you imagine Angel Hernandez ruining Game 7 of a World Series?
I mean, you don't have to. He ruined Game 6 in 2007, I think, and that's why he's not allowed to do it anymore.
Oh, that's right. Oh, that's right. I totally forgot about that.
The contract wasn't ratified until the 18th, so replacement umpires were still in place on the 17th, and worked an infamously insane game between the Phillies and Cubs where the final score was 23-22 in 10 innings. I just thought that was interesting. It doesn't have much to do with the umpiring, but...
No, you don't see a lot of 23-22 games.
Now, although attention has been focused on contract negotiations, umpires also successfully used the power of their union to seek from league presidents and the commissioner impositions of fines and suspensions on the players, on the managers, and on the owners, which I find fascinating. And this has happened a number of times where they've stepped up and said, if this player doesn't act right, you know, we're going to strike or we're going to throw a fit or whatever. Like, you need to get this guy in line or else. And this is kind of why around the 1990s, umpires are starting to be the bad guys. Before, it was just kind of a guy that was there doing the rules. And now they're seen as too powerful, too vindictive, openly hostile because of all this extreme power. Now, in the late 1990s, and maybe this is inspired a little bit by the MLBPA strike, the big lockout in the mid-90s. In the late 90s, they decide time to strike again. But this one's a little bit different. Phillips advocated a strategy of mass resignations in hopes of forcing negotiations for a new collective bargaining agreement. Did not work at all. Because the MLB was just like, okay, go ahead and quit. Because at this point, compared to the 70s, they've got a full league in the minors ready to go to be umpires again. So they just hire, they're not scabs this time. These are professional, trained umpires ready to go. 23 umps, including Phillips, lost their job. Consequently, the MLUA voted to disband that same year. They reorganized in 2000 as the World Umpires Association, now known as the MLB Umpires Association. They're still unionized. The ump union still has a decent amount of power, but that was the one moment that the league really stepped up and said, no, you're not doing it this time.
Yeah. I was pausing for a second because I do think there is one notable thing to mention about umpires that did occur in the 90s, and that is the death of John McSherry on the field on opening day.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, an umpire died on the field in 1996, and I remember I was in the library of my high school where we had the game on, because back then Cincinnati always played the first game of the season. It was a Cincinnati game. He died. He had a heart attack on the field, and then notable, terrible former owner of the Cincinnati Reds, Marge Schott, got really mad that they were going to cancel the game, and the man died on the fucking field. So
good reason to cancel a game, in my opinion.
Absolutely. I know that was a bit off topic. I know you'd kind of moved past that, but I thought it would be a good thing to mention about umpires in the 90s. So there you go.
Well, let's bring us now to current day and why this union has been a little bit kind of scary, brazen with the way they operate, especially around players. I had a couple of particular examples, and one of them came out of 2017. Ian Kinsler was fined $10,000 for claiming that Angel Hernandez should pursue a different occupation, which, fair. Earlier that same season, Joe West was suspended, not fined, suspended, for calling Adrian Beltre the biggest complainer in the game. Umpires, in response, banded together and wore white wristbands to protest player treatment, saying the league was unfair in punishing West harder than they did Kinsler, lack of enforcement for players misbehaving, blah, blah, blah. So that was 2017. They had a little hissy fit. We move on. Now we're on 2019, and this one was bad.
Yeah.
Manny Machado was ejected for arguing an admittedly shitty third strike call by home plate ump Bill Welke. Machado, understandably steamed, threw his bat and helmet at the backstop while shouting at Welke and exiting the field. He was suspended for one game. Again, understandable. You shouldn't do that. Okay, moving on.
But wait! But he threw the bat and the helmet at what? The backstop.
Right.
That's important for what you're about to read.
Yeah. Didn't throw it at anybody. Didn't really direct his anger too violently toward anybody. But the MLBUA took to Twitter to respond using hashtags such as disappointed, lead by example, not appreciated, violence, temper tantrum, inaction, not tolerated, make an example of, one game suspension, repeat offender, nonsense. Again, these are hashtags used in the year of our Lord 2019. Does anybody use hashtags anymore?
That is the tweet equivalent of getting a chain email from an uncle with 17 FW colons in the subject line.
And that's not even their press release. That one read, Manny Machado received a one-game suspension for contact with an umpire over balls and strikes and violently throwing his bat against the backstop with absolutely no regard for anyone's safety. Violence in the workplace is not tolerated, and offenders are dealt with severely and even made examples of for the good of its employees. It's is spelled incorrectly there, yeah. As well as the company itself. Is this truly what MLB wants to teach our youth? The tweet was so bizarre and uncalled for, the league actually called them out in a statement addressing the issue, saying, "We do not believe it's appropriate for the union representing umpires to comment on the discipline of players. We also believe it's inappropriate to compare this incident to the extraordinary serious issue of workplace violence."
So if you're of a certain age, you remember the phrase going postal.
Yes.
Because there was a time in the 90s when people were shooting up post offices. That's workplace violence.
Yeah.
This is a dude throwing a bat in a helmet.
Throwing a little bit of a fit. I'm not a Manny Machado fan. Listeners of this podcast know that. But like, what the fuck is this?
What kind of grandstanding snowflake bullshit is the... Man.
When they've only gotten worse as we've handed them more power and more rules to check, because now they've got the pitch clock. Now they're paying more attention to, you know, how many pickoff attempts you have, and they're not doing a very good job at that. But the worst is the sticky substance check, which was handed around middle of last season when they started doing that, and now it's become a regular practice. If you fail a sticky substance check, it's an automatic 10-game suspension. You can appeal it, but you're probably not going to win because the league, more often than not, sides with umpires. So it's one guy and his fingers against you, and his crew is going to back him up. I think several pitchers, notably including MLBPA rep Max Scherzer, were suspended despite arguing there is nothing illegitimate about the tack they used. Scherzer pled up and down, it's just sweat, rosin, sunscreen, that's all it is. And I believe him. You know, it was it Domingo Herman, you know, all of his faults and foibles aside, he said that he was applying rosin in the dugout and they said, "That's too much rosin, go wash it off." And then when he came back with too much again, they were like, "Okay, now you're suspended." There's no standard for how much rosin is too much rosin. It's just on the umpire. This is all the power that they've gone to their head. And we talked about that earlier in the season, of course. Mm-hmm. Just another thing to give them the big ego and the big power trip.
And you were saying earlier, we were joking about the guy, you know, getting busted for gambling. This is all subjective.
Yeah.
So let's say, for example, there's an umpire who's just hypothetically on the take and they go do a sticky substance check in a very pivotal playoff game. And they are just like, "Nope, you're sticky." And they yank, you know, a starting pitcher in the second inning. And now a team has got to go from the bullpen the entire rest of the game. That could happen. I'm not saying it has, but that's too much power.
Yes. And again, no, there's nothing you can do about it. Not even after the fact, really. If owners aren't allowed to collectively bargain, like, you know, we've touched a little bit about it, but there was an instance in the late 80s where owners were basically colluding against their players and making it so they couldn't fetch money in free agency. The judge made that illegal. Owners aren't allowed to collectively bargain. Why are umpires? If they're the arbiters of the laws of baseball, they should not be allowed to have this massive amount of power.
Yeah, and you can't criticize them.
No.
In any sport, you cannot criticize the officiants, or, you know, the officials of those sports. You can't do it, which is insane. It's just fucking insane to me.
Well, what sets baseball apart from most sports is they take training seriously, and I find that peculiar given their performance.
Given literally everything we talked about for the last 15 minutes.
But now we're going to talk about how umpires become umpires. The first step to pursuing a career as a professional umpire is you got to go to camp. You got to learn. You got to train. You are taught by this MLB umpire supervisory staff. The camps are nationwide. No cost to attend. You and I could go be umps tomorrow. Yep. Well, I can't because I wear glasses. Oh, wait. No, it's legal now. That's right.
There you go.
Finalists go through a vetting process, and then they get invited to umpire prospect development camp. So they only take the best out of the individual national camps to go to Florida, invite only, all expense paid, 4-week course, and you basically get a crash course in professional umpiring. During that camp, your performance and abilities are evaluated by the development staff, and at the conclusion, if you do a good job, you could offer it a job. right away. And you could start basically the same way players do. You start in the Florida Development League. You work your way up to double A or single A, double A, all the way through the minors. Basically the same path the players do, except there's way fewer umpires, way fewer jobs. It's a very selective job. There's not too many of them available in the league. There's five levels. Umpires are afforded the opportunity to skip levels depending on how good they do. But you also have to remember that there's guys in the league that have been umpiring for 20, 30 years. Joe West just retired last year.
Yep.
And he's been doing it since before I was born.
Cowboy Joe West, boy, don't miss that guy.
So long and short of it, it's a very small pool of guys that are able to do this, which is crazy that like we've got so many old guys. Man, this is really the problem with our country in general. I mean, all the old people on the top that are bad at their jobs, holding the rest of us down.
I second that. I stand by you.
Thank you.
Just so you know, you're welcome. And it's, yeah, I got, let's edit that. Yeah. Well, if you want to move on, because we talked about how they're trained and everything, and now we're in the year 2023, and we have something, a lot of people have asked, is umpiring worse now than ever before? And the answer is, in my opinion, probably not. And the reason for that is because we actually now have technology and the ability to truly track, at least with a strong degree of accuracy, just how good or bad umpires are, thanks to predominantly two great Twitter accounts and one great website, Umpire Auditor over on Twitter, and then Umpire Scorecards, which also has a website that I got a bunch of the information that you're about to hear. We talked about Angel Hernandez. You mentioned at the top of your segment the September 14th game. So we covered that. We talked about that. That was the worst game of the year thus far.
I'm pretty sure he also owns several of the other top spots too, right?
Oh, yeah.
Or
oh,
bottom
yeah.
Spots?
No, he's bad. Now, he still didn't have the most blown calls. Now, Umpire Scorecards and Umpire Auditor, they track these things differently. But according to Umpire Auditor, on September 5th of this year, Larry Vanover set the watermark, the high or low watermark, depending on how you want to view this, by blowing a season high 29 calls. And everything that we're about to talk about here, unless otherwise noted, I've provided Matt with links to put into the show notes. Now that I've mentioned it on the record, I think you have to put them in there.
Probably.
you can go and click on these links and see just how bad Larry Vanover was. Some other notable umpiring foibles from the season. August 27th of this year, Nick Marley recorded the lowest strike of the season when he called a strike on the 6'2" Jaimer Candelario on a pitch that was 12.9 inches off the ground and was a whopping 5.31 inches below the strike zone. I could not find any information on what was the furthest out of the zone pitch on the top of the zone. But this one, according to Umpire Auditor, as of this record, is the lowest strike call. Umpire Auditor has a great tweet they send out once a week where they'll say how many blown calls there were, and then they will rank the 10 worst by distance outside of the strike zone. And generally speaking, in order to get that number one spot, you've got to be off by at least 5 inches. I think the worst one that I saw was 5.62 inches.
Jesus Christ.
Off the plate. And that is, even in my men's league games, that would still not be called a strike. They widen those strike zones because we're just a bunch of amateurs out there.
Well, your announcers talk about like balls width. The ball is roughly about 2 inches wide. You talk about a ball's width, and the plate itself is what, 12 inches wide? 13.
13
so,
inches.
So, you know, we're talking physical things that you can see. I know we talked about how the zone is not real, but the plate is. A ball is a guy's knees and a guy's chest are. So like those are things that you're like, if it's two or three real human balls that you can see coming at you that far away from the human plate, that's not good.
Are we not doing phrasing anymore, Mr. Mr. Two Human Balls? Now, if we're talking elephant balls, well, then that's way off the plate.
Okay.
As of this record, there have been 44 instances this season of a batter hitting a home run after they should have been called out on strikes. And the most recent occurrence happened on August 27th when George Springer homered off of Noah Syndergaard after taking what should have been strike three at the knees. The tweet did not include the umpire's name, and I could have gone back and referenced it, but I didn't.
Nah.
Why do that? Why do research? We only had a week to prepare for this episode. The worst called game of the first half of the season. We all know who has the worst game of the season. It's Angel Hernandez.
Yeah.
The worst called first game of the game of the first half of the season belongs to Ryan Blackney. He missed 26 calls in the July 7th tilt between the Brewers and the Reds for an 85.1% accuracy rate.
Yeesh.
Now, when you go, if you're not familiar with umpire scorecards, it's amazing. I highly suggest you check it out. Their database is magnificent. Their tweets are fantastic, but they have a lot of stats, including like, you know, how much the calls affected the outcome of the game one way or another, and how accurate they are and their expected accuracy. And we've talked at length about bad umpire performances, but I'd like to wrap this part of the segment up and shout out some of the best this year. And the most accurate umpiring performance this season, according to umpire scorecards, belongs to Ben May, who missed one call in a game out of 149 pitches when he called a ball on a pitch that just ever so slightly tickled the strike zone. It was a strike. He did call it a ball, and I'm going to go look at it right here because I didn't mention it. It was May 16th, Tampa Bay versus the Mets, as a matter of fact. He only missed one call, and it was just a absolute, just a, as they'd say on Letterkenny, a sea hair in the zone. But he's not one of the best of the season. The five most accurate umpires this season, and I'd like to point something out here after I read the five names. Quinn Wolcott, 96% accuracy rating. Pat Hoberg with a 95.5% accuracy rating. He's tied with Jansen Visconti at 95.5%.
Great baseball name.
Yes. Alan Porter at 95.4% and Derek Thomas at 95.3%. Those are the five most accurate umpires this season. There are two. If you go and try to like check my work on umpire scorecards, there are two guys that rank above these five, but the two guys that rank above them have only worked one game behind the plate.
Oh.
So I did not include them. All of these guys have worked at least 25 or 26 games this season.
Yeah,
now,
they're not qualified umpires for a baseball term.
No. Now, I have to confess that I did not know all of these umpires' names. I know who Pat Hoberg is. I've heard the name Alan Porter, but Quinn Wolcott, Jansen Visconti,
household names like we mentioned.
Derek
earlier.
Thomas. No, they're not household names. And you know why? Because they're so fucking good at their jobs. And isn't that a kick in the goddamn nuts for these guys? They're the best of the best, but all anybody wants to talk about is CB Buckner, Joe West, Phil Cuzzy, Angel Hernandez, the bad umpires.
Well, Carl, I have to ask, I don't know if you did this element of the research. How old are these guys? Because I'm pretty sure these are all much younger umpires than your Buckners and your Hernandezes.
Yes. And now that information was not included, and I did not go that deep. Umpire scorecards stops pretty much at their performance.
Sure.
If I remember correct, I think Pat Hoberg is sort of like, and I could be wildly off base here, but if I remember correctly, Pat Hoberg is sort of like that hip older guy who just, you know, took to technology. Like, he wasn't afraid to learn kind of thing. Oh no, he was born in 1986.
Yeah, Hoberg and Wolcott are 37. Age on Visconti.
Yeah, I think Alan Porter might be a little bit older.
Porter, he looks really, he's 45.
All right, I'm 45. I'll take that. And then Derek Thomas, we're not talking about the late great Kansas City Chief linebacker Derek Thomas. I don't see anything
on him. Yeah, but I mean, so three out of those five we know officially are under the age of 50. Probably a sign that maybe the younger umpires, by the math, by the books, are the better performing umpires.
Absolutely. And I would like to go on record as saying umpiring is not hard. Calling balls and strikes is hard. I've been behind the plate for like men's league games and stuff like that. And even some of these dudes that can get it up there in the low 80s and still make, you know, put a little spin on it.
Get it up there.
Yeah. You think it's easy. You think it, but then all of a sudden that little cut action at the end, you're like, whoa, I didn't realize you could do that. Oh, wait, was that in the zone? Where did that cross the plate? I think we should just do it like really like high level competitive wiffle ball and just have a target. You hit the target, you hit the target, it's a strike. You don't hit the target, it's a ball.
I think that that's totally fair. We've seen it with when I was watching the John Boy Media. Not pickleball. What's it called? Not wiffle ball.
Blitzball.
Blitzball. Thank you. Blitzball has a hard PVC pipe laden target, and it's great. I don't know, like, take a lot of the fun out of the catching element of baseball, but
yeah, you obviously cannot realistically do it, but it'd be nice if you somehow could.
Wasn't there a game I sent you a couple months ago that basically in a flash animation way puts you in, as an umpire, and you umpire a game?
Yeah, I was bad at it.
Me too. Surprisingly bad at it.
I was so bad at it. I thought it was going to be way... I'm way better at Immaculate Grid. I usually come in at 7. I usually get 7 out of every 9 on the Immaculate Grid. That game, I almost threw it out the window here in my office.
Yeah. I'll link that one in the notes, too. Let's see how our listeners do at that. The Umpire Simulator. But what is the future of umpiring? Because clearly it's not your Angels Hernandez or your CB's Buckner. You would hope it's guys like Wolcott, Hoberg, but then again, they're going to get older and they're going to start sucking. We need a concrete plan, and everybody keeps saying robo-umps, but this is a big but. Robo-umps are not all they're cracked up to be. For one, they're not like actual like C-3PO standing behind the plate. That would be really fun. Like, you know the Fox Sports football when they had like that big football robot? I imagine that guy standing behind a catcher ball.
I'd rather it be R2-D2 complete with beeps and whistles, and the batters are just like, what the am I out?
Yeah, you have to have a Luke Skywalker type, like, what's that R2? It's a strike? Nah, you're out, bud.
Sorry, man. The R2 said you're out.
So with StatCast, with the advent of pitch tracking cameras, it is possible to have a virtual strike zone. They call it the Automated Ball Strike System, or ABS. And they've started to develop it. I mean, they started to develop it years ago for baseball broadcasting purposes. But now it's starting to become a thing used in game. And they're kind of experimenting with it in AAA. So as we speak, this whole season, Tuesday through Thursday, the ABS system is exclusively in control of balls and strikes, while the rest of the time, there is a challenge system to complement the human umps. So basically, if an umpire calls a strike that the batter thinks is a ball, they tap the top of their helmet, and then it goes straight to video replay, and then on the scoreboard, they'll show you a visualization of the strike zone and where the pitch landed. And I want to say the rules kind of operate like challenges do throughout the game now. If you use a challenge and you're wrong, you lose your challenge, right? I didn't write that part down.
Yeah, you're right. If you lose a challenge, if you're wrong on a challenge, you lose the challenge. At the MLB level, that said, I don't know how it works vis-a-vis automated balls and strikes at the minor league
level. You can't just sit there and tap your helmet for every pitch that the umpire calls. You have to selectively use this ability. So far, players seem really apprehensive about going full robot. And we're going to link to a story from The Athletic that came out a little bit ago that really illustrated how the players actually feel about this. It's one thing when they're yelling at the umpires in a major league stadium. It's another thing when there's nobody to yell at. And they have really good questions from a player's standpoint about how effective this could be. You know, how does the strike zone work? You know, is it the same in every ballpark? Is it the same? Is it consistent between tall players and short players? Because their strike zones are different. The strike zone goes from what? Your belt to your knees? Is that right?
That's more or less where it's at these days. I mean, when I grew up, I was always taught, like, you know, knees to letters or like,
yeah,
you know,
letters
knees
to your
nipples.
Jerseys or like the first yeah. button of your jersey or something like that.
Yeah, but at the major league level, it's usually right around the bottom of the knee to the top of the belt.
But also, how does the robot look at a guy like a Jose Altuve who's short and stands up straight versus an Aaron Judge who's very tall and kneels? You know, like how equal in size is it? Is it willing to call a strike at the top of the zone, you know, or a ball, you know, are you going to be safely be like, well, that's always a ball. No, it's not. It's a strike. Joey Votto ran into this problem. You see in the article, he was doing a rehab assignment and he could not figure out the strike zone to save his life. And he's been a major league player for 20 years.
Yeah. I would also say go back and watch some footage of Ricky Henderson at bats in his famous crouch.
Mm-hmm.
Could guys just start trying to crouch and yeah. manipulate the strike zone? You know, I mean, pitchers hated Ricky Henderson for a variety of reasons, not the least of which was the fact that he shrunk the strike zone and the umpires called it based on the way he was standing.
Yeah. Would the robot do the same? Like, right. that's the big question. Is taking the human element out of umpiring really what we want? And personally, as a fan, I think I'd prefer the challenge system. I think that that allows for the umpires to still have their jobs, but allow some kind of transparency and some kind of fight back if they're wrong. And they're wrong a lot. And the players know when they're wrong, you know?
Yeah, and I completely agree. And I think it would ultimately be good for the players to get a better understanding of the strike zone, because that'll help teach them the strike zone. Like, you'll stop tapping that helmet every damn time if you keep getting them wrong.
Yes.
You know, but I completely agree. I think that's a great idea, is have it and then let them challenge, and you can lose the challenge. It's one more thing to keep track of, but Jesus Christ, we could put a man on the moon. We can keep track of how many times a dude's tapped his helmet. That's honestly the best idea that I've heard to date, is keeping, because I this is the line that I would not be willing to cross. I, as much as I gripe about it, I could not stand fully automated balls and strikes.
I don't think so. I think it's too much. If I can get personal a little bit, I don't like this AI rise. I don't like how much technology has been put out of our hands and automated and controlled in the cloud or whatever. I think that taking an umpire out of baseball entirely would kind of take that small human element out of it. And I think it needs to be fixed. I think the fixes exist, but I don't think that's how you fix it.
No, I completely agree. That said, we can get rid of Angel Hernandez any day. I would rather have a robot Angel Hernandez. I would rather have Leslie Nielsen from the Naked Gun series in his efforts in that famous film, calling balls and strikes, than Angel Hernandez. But you're right. That is a bridge too far for me. I couldn't do it.
When I was a kid, my parents got a new fridge. And so the box that the fridge came in became my toy robot. I like designed a robot out of the box. I would put that behind home plate and would probably call a better game than Angel Hernandez.
I was wondering where you're going with that. And I'm glad I tagged along.
Thank you. So that, I think, wraps up our long overdue conversation about umpires. As we speak, when you're hearing this episode, I think it was relatively tight. I think this is going to be one episode. So next week, you know, is the last week of the season, the full week of the season. And we'll see how the umpires do there. Could Angel Hernandez do worse than September 14th, 2023? Time will tell.
He's got time. I'm hopeful. I believe in him.
Other than that, Carl, any closing thoughts on umpires?
You're better than this. Most of you, most of you are better than this. And I get it. It's a hard job, but I believe in you.
I have a theory about Javi Baez, if we can close on this.
Yes.
You know the movie Major League?
Love it.
You know Charlie Sheen's character, Wild Thing, how he is a great pitcher, but he has no control. And about halfway through the movie, they say, hey, we think we can fix you. Wear these glasses. And then suddenly he's a very good pitcher because he decided to wear glasses. I think Javi Baez and his strike zone issues could be solved by putting some glasses on him. And I think the same could be said about so many of these umpires. You don't see him wear these glasses. It's totally legal. Not a taboo. Wear some glasses, guys.
LASIK, contacts, anything.
Something.
Javi's already got like almost a Rick Vaughn like haircut. He's got the shaved sides.
Yeah.
Throw some big Coke bottle. What we used to call in the Army, we used to call them BCGs, birth control glasses, because nobody's gonna want to sleep with you when you're wearing those things. Put those on him.
Yeah.
Can't do any worse. He's literally one of the worst qualified hitters in all of baseball this year.
If I'm not mistaken, he is the worst.
There you go.
Javi Baez is the Angel Hernandez of baseball. Well, I guess that'd be Angel Hernandez too.
Javi Baez is the Angel Hernandez of trying to hit a baseball while Angel Hernandez is behind. This got away from us.
All right.
Scrap the whole episode. We're done. Right.
Thanks for joining us on Put Me In Coach. We'll see you guys next week.
Put Me In Coach is an Arctic Sounds original podcast hosted by Matt Coggins and Carl Mizell. Theme music is by Quack Quack Seatback. Edited and produced by Matt Coggins. Check out the footnotes of this episode to see links to all the great highlights, articles, and sources we mentioned on the podcast today, as well as the full theme song and ways to get in touch with us. For more, find us on Twitter and Instagram at PutMeInPod or at our website, PutMeInCoachPod.com.